This morning, we had a look at, mainly we were focusing on these three poisons. How these three poisons are, they poison our mind and they're the root of our problems and sufferings. And within these three poisons we had ignorance, anger, or aversion and attachment. And we saw in that process how it's the ignorance that is underlying all of our disturbing emotions, this fundamental ignorance, misunderstanding nature of reality. Now, we can look at that misunderstanding at a few levels, and the Buddha described a couple of different levels. And what we can do is begin at a little bit more superficial level. See, at the time of the Buddha, there are a number of spiritual traditions already active, and many of these traditions were talking about life, many lives, and they were talking about this idea of being liberated from suffering. And so any tradition that talks about something after this life has to posit what is the connection, what is it that actually goes from life to life. And so many of these traditions were positing this idea of an Atman, usually translated as self in Buddhism, that there's a thing called an Atman that goes from life to life, and that's the Atman that achieves liberation from suffering. And so what the Buddha did was, one of the first things was he refuted this idea of an Atman, a self. And we can talk about this at least two levels as well. Now, the first idea of an Atman that he was refuting was that many traditions at his time were talking about an Atman that had three qualities. And the Atman was the thing that went from life to life and achieved liberation. One thing first though, again, this word self in Buddhism, we have to also be a bit careful with this word. Generally, in the context of a discussion of nature of reality, then the word self is referring to this Sanskrit word Atman. But of course, when we talk in other contexts, we talk about self and other. We're not, this word self is not referring to Atman. So here the word self is referring to a belief in the way, a certain way that we exist as a person. We believe we exist as this self, this Atman. So that's how this word self is used in this context. But in more general context, when this discussion is not about the nature of reality, we can just talk about, you know, self and other. There we're not talking about how we exist. We're just distinguishing ourselves from other people, that's all. But here, one idea of Atman or self that the Buddha refuted was that many traditions believed that there was this me, this self, that went from life to life and that had three qualities. That the Atman or the self was something that was unchanging, unitary and independent. Here independent means completely independent of anything else. Unitary means that it's a single thing, it has no parts. And of course unchanging means not changing from moment to moment. And so this was a belief in an Atman or self that a number of traditions had at the time of the Buddha, and the Buddha refuted that the Atman or the self or the person has these three qualities, that it's unchanging, unitary, independent. Now, according to Buddhism, this is, we would not instinctively have this sense of me. Because here that would mean a sense of me that's completely independent of the body and the mind. It would mean that we would have instinctively the sense of me somewhere over there, completely separate from the body and the mind. And we don't instinctively have a sense of me which is completely separate from our body and mind. It's only on the basis of the body and the mind that we have a sense of me. So according to Buddhism, this idea would only be an idea that we came through some false way of thinking or reasoning. That we would, through some false reasoning, come to think that the real me that is something that has these qualities. But there was a second idea of Atman or self that the Buddha refuted, that we do instinctively have. Is that we have a sense of being self-sufficient, substantially existent. It feels like it's self-sufficient, and substantially existent again also means it feels quite solid existing within itself. Normally this is referred to, the example would be to have the sense of me that we have is a sense of me as being the master or the controller. So normally this is the way it's sort of described, is that we have the sense that somehow in here, somewhere, there's a me here who's running the show. We sort of have that a little bit in our language, you know, this idea of there's a me that's the master or controller. We have, because often we say things like, you know, I have a body, I have a mind. I'm trying to control this body and the mind. I am the master. I'm trying to master this body and the mind. As if, in addition to the body and the mind, there's something a little bit more, this me, that's somehow a little bit more than the body and the mind, that sort of stands apart from the body and the mind, that's a little bit self-sufficient, not really existing depending on the body and the mind, but somehow mixed in here. There's something in addition to the body and the mind, this me, that is the master or the controller that's trying to control this body and the mind. You know, we sometimes have this sort of thought. Maybe we have a thought sometimes, you know, we look at this body and we go, oh, I don't really like this body. I'd like to swap it for a better one, you know, a younger, fitter, more beautiful body. Sometimes we have this thought, you know. And then we might look at our own mind and think, oh, my mind's a mess, you know, it's awful. In fact, I'd like to swap it for a more intelligent, more loving, a better mind. I want to swap it for a better one. Sometimes we have these thoughts. But if we look at those thoughts, then where is this me that could do this swap? Where is the me here that could swap this body and the mind for a new one? If we look for that me, it's going to be very difficult to find it. Because when we look here, then there's a body, yes, there's a mind, yes. But what is there more than the body and the mind here? It would be difficult, I think, to find something that's in addition to that. But that's often the sense of me that we have. We have a sense of me that there is a me here somewhere that's a little bit more than the body and the mind, that stands apart from the body and the mind, that is the master of the body and the mind, that's trying to control the body and the mind. This sense of self we have, but the Buddha refuted this. And again, if we investigate and look here to find this master or controller, this me, that stands apart from the body and the mind, I think we're not going to be able to find it. So this is then this idea of selflessness, that in Buddhism we can talk about there's no such self and there's certainly no such self, that the Buddha refuted these two ideas of self. And so hence we have this idea of selflessness, because this is an artificially inflated sense of me. Both of them are, but this one's only one we would get through some wrong way of study. But this one we instinctively have, that we really do feel as if there is this solid me here, somewhere mixed in here, that is a little bit more than the body and the mind, that is the master, that's the controller. And so if we to realize there's no such self is this realization of selflessness, or in Sanskrit, anatma. Now, in some of the Buddhist traditions, it's said that this is what we need to realize, that there's no such self. This selflessness will help, if we can realize that, that's the ignorance that stops trapping us in samsara, and if we can realize that, we can achieve the state of nirvana. But in the highest level of understanding of the Buddhist teachings, which is the what's called the Majjhimika philosophical view, this realization there's no such self is helpful, definitely, but there's a deeper level of ignorance operating than this. That deeper level of ignorance that's operating is, again, a belief that there's an independent me and an independent objective world, this idea of dualistic duality. And so that's then we come into this discussion about emptiness, shunyata. So what I thought would be nice to do to begin our discussions about this was to read a bit from Alan Wallace in one of his books called Tibetan Buddhism from the Ground Up, and the title of the section is called What is Really There. But before I do that, is there any questions about any of that? Is there anything that's sort of not clear about that?
Is that second one the same as the Christian concept of the soul?
Also in Christianity, because you know they also posit something after this life, so any tradition that posits anything after this life has to say what goes on. And of course generally in Christianity we talk about the idea of soul, but again soul is just a word, and as we saw here, self or atman is a word, can refer to a couple of different things here. So likewise I think in Christianity the word soul, depending on who you talk to, can have a different description about what it is and how it exists. So it really depends on a person's interpretation of that word. But if a person's interpretation is that soul is something that doesn't really change, that it's a single thing, it doesn't really have parts, and it exists completely independent of the body and the mind, then that idea of soul, of course, Buddhism would refute, would say that that idea of soul would be illogical. It couldn't really exist. But I think these days, particularly in the sort of more contemplative Christianity, I think there are probably people whose definition of the word soul would fit much more in terms of Buddhist view. But again, it would depend on who you talk to, I think. I think more traditionally, the idea of soul would probably more be... would be something like that. So I think that definition of soul, Buddhism would say, well, that would be something that would be a little bit illogical to have that idea of soul. But again, I think now these days some other people's idea of soul could be much more in line and acceptable within a Buddhist philosophical context. So it really depends on our definition of that word.
I was actually conditioned in terms of having a soul rather than being a soul.
Yeah, we were taught growing up having a soul.
Having right, so then if that means the case, then you die and you don't go to heaven or hell. It's the soul that goes to heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
But didn't you say when you grew up, I'm hoping to go to heaven?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So isn't that a bit illogical?
It's just the terminology. Yeah.
If you say, I think I'm going to go to heaven, and I have a soul, and it's the soul that goes to heaven, that sounds a bit strange, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah.
But of course, maybe we're not encouraged to think about those sorts of things. I don't know.
I certainly wasn't.
But it doesn't make sense, and it didn't make sense to me then.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have to think about these things logically, and that's what we need to investigate. And that sort of idea, I think, probably is more in line with this. Because here we're talking about something that's completely independent of the body and the mind.
Absolutely.
So that idea, from a Buddhist perspective, wouldn't really make so much sense. But I'm sure there are other ideas about soul which would fit much better in the Buddhist context. So again, soul is just a word.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Atman is a word, mm-hmm. can refer to different things. Yeah. Okay, then let's introduce this idea, or talk about this idea of this belief in an independent, me-independent world, this idea of subject-object duality. Which comes into the topic of shunyata or emptiness. But to begin, let's read a little bit from Alan Wallace, who says the following. Many of us believe that we directly perceive objective physical phenomena with our five physical senses, that the mental images we perceive via our senses are accurate representations of the objects we perceive. However, neurologist Antonio Damasio refutes this assumption, which is commonly called naive realism. So now he's quoting the neurologist, who says, "When you and I look at an object outside ourselves, we form comparable images in our respective brains. We know this well because you and I can describe the object in very similar ways, down to fine details. But that does not mean that the image we see is the copy of whatever the object outside is like. Whatever it is like, in absolute terms, we do not know." Now back to Alan Wallace. In light of this neuroscientific view, with our five senses, we directly perceive images generated in the brain. But these are not truly representations of anything existing independently of the brain. These sensory impressions of colours, sounds, smells and so on are no more tangible than thoughts or dreams. While we seem to experience colours and so on as they exist in the objective world, independent of our senses, this is an illusion, very much like a dream. Having determined that the reality we perceive depends on our sense faculties, what then really does exist outside our senses? When we close this book and leave the room, shutting the door behind us, what remains? It is an ancient question that has been asked since the time of the Greeks. What exists behind appearances? What really exists out there? This brings up a familiar problem. What happens when a tree falls and nobody is in the forest to watch it or hear it? Most people agree something happened. The tree trunk is on the ground, there is a big dent, things start to rot, ants and termites live in the fallen trunk. But what happened? Western scientists have traditionally responded to this question by trying to find primary or intrinsic qualities of the falling tree that can be measured. Mass is one of those, the idea being that the tree has a quantifiable amount of stuff to it. Speed is another quality that does not seem to depend on anyone's perception. Briefly considering the history of Western scientific thinking on this point may be a useful digression that may help us better understand the nature of emptiness. Also, by examining our cultural assumptions about the nature of reality, we can better understand and penetrate those assumptions, and by so doing, come to appreciate the Buddhist view. Since Galileo turned his telescope and turned it on, took his telescope and turned it on Jupiter, scientific thought has increasingly depended on the power of mechanical instruments. We get the sense, and it is widely promoted by science, that by using mechanical instruments and mathematics, we stop being subjective and instead become objective. Everyone knows the senses can be misleading, it is said, so let us dispense with the senses. They are giving us only appearances anyway, and we are trying to penetrate through those. The idea of objective measurement came to be strongly emphasized during the time of Galileo, and by the end of the 19th century, scientists felt the objective science of physics was virtually complete. The physics of the time was assumed, with very few exceptions, to be an absolute representation of what was really out there. At the beginning of the 20th century, this view began to break down. Scientists started to understand more clearly that their instruments of measurement were themselves contributing to the data they were detecting. But the real revolution came with the development of quantum physics, which investigates the very smallest components of physical reality. It is here that the participatory nature of measurement and experimentation becomes most obvious. In quantum mechanics, attributes of mass, speed, shape and location vanish as purely objective entities. All of them can only be seen in relationship to the methods of measurement. As the renowned physicist Werner Heisenberg said, "What we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning." As scientists looked still deeper, they also started questioning the objectivity of the analytical tools they use. Mathematics, for instance, is one more human creation. Euclidean geometry is only one of a theoretically infinite number of geometries that can be used, and the same goes for algebra and various logic systems. The subjective element seems to be inescapable on all fronts. In no facet of science, whether we are dealing with astronomy, physics or medicine, do we get even one bit of information about any reality existing independently of our modes of questioning. All our sensory experience consists of experiences that are contingent upon the sense faculties. Even by reducing everything to the subatomic level of electrons, quarks and so forth, we are still left with nothing but appearances. What is inescapable is that all we know of the world, theoretically and empirically, consists of appearances to the mind. We have access to nothing else. Okay, with that in mind, let's have a look now at this view of shunyata or emptiness. As I said, when we look out on the world, things appear to us to exist completely independent of us. So this idea of independent existence, in Buddhism there's a number of terms that are used to describe this. Of course they all mean the same thing, they all mean independent existence, but they describe independent existence from a slightly different perspective. Probably the most common term you're going to see is the word inherent existence when we talk about emptiness. So inherent existence has the idea of things being self-existent, existing within themselves, that they have their own unique self-contained existence. The second word is things existing from their own side. You know, the idea that of flowers existing from their own side, meaning that we are in no way contributing to the existence of those flowers. They exist completely from their own side without the need of an observer or an agent, a consciousness. The third term is true existence. In English, the word true means something existing in the way it appears to us. True means something that doesn't deceive us. And so here, in terms of true existence, is something would have true existence if the way in which it appears and the way it would exist match. Things appear to exist independent of us. If they really existed in that way, they would be true, meaning the way in which they appear and the way in which they exist are matching. They wouldn't be deceiving us. It wouldn't be that they appear to exist one way and exist another way. Then they wouldn't have true existence. So these three words all mean independent existence. And that's how the world appears to us. And again, as we said, we just buy into those appearances, we accept those appearances. But what this view is saying is that we need to investigate these appearances and see whether or not, in fact, things exist in the way they appear to us. Do things, in fact, independently exist? And of course, what the Buddha discovered was that wasn't the case, that things are not independently existent. But of course, the Buddha wasn't saying that flowers don't exist. What he was saying was that they do not independently exist. So therefore, if things are not independently existent, but they exist, then they must exist dependently. So the reasoning that we have in Buddhism is the following. So we have the statement, things are empty of inherent existence, meaning things are not independently existent because they are dependent arisings, which is the Buddhist term for things existing dependently. So here the word arising means coming into existence. So things are coming into existence dependently. So again, things are empty of inherent existence, or they lack inherent existence, or they lack independent existence because they are dependently existent. So this phrase here, so the fact that things are empty of inherent existence is emptiness, or in Sanskrit, shunyata. So emptiness doesn't mean nothing really exists. Emptiness means that things are empty or lack a certain type of existence. What they lack is being independently existent or inherently existent. So emptiness means things are not independently existent. Why? Because they are dependently existent. They are dependent arisings. So, to really understand what we mean then by emptiness, we really need to understand what we mean by dependent arisings. What does it mean for something to exist dependently? If we can appreciate that, then we can really appreciate the idea of emptiness better. We can talk about things being dependently existent at three levels, or in three ways. The first is that things exist depending on causes and conditions. You know, this clock here, for instance, funny looking cube thing, exists depending on causes and conditions. One of the first conditions we need for that to exist, of course, is sometime in the past, someone needed to think about designing this clock. Then, of course, we needed to gather all the raw materials for the various components, refine those raw materials. Then we needed to make the various components of the clock, then we needed to get all those components together and we needed to assemble the clock. So all of those materials, all the people, all the factories, all the things that were involved in that whole process are the causes and conditions necessary. So without all of those causes and conditions coming together, we wouldn't have a clock here today. I think that's fairly straightforward, nothing magical about that idea. Also, this clock is dependent on its parts to exist. To have this clock, of course, we need the plastic casing, we need the display on the front, we need probably a battery, some dials, some electronic components in the middle. Without all of these parts here, there would be no clock. So again, the clock can only exist depending on all of its parts. Again, pretty straightforward. But here, remember, what we're saying is that this idea of dependent arising should be refuting the fact that things are independently existent. Should be. That's what the reasoning is saying here. But I'm probably true in suggesting that for all of us here, we can happily accept that this clock exists depending on its causes and conditions. It exists depending on its parts, but when I walk out that door, there's still a clock here, and when I walk in the door, there's already a clock here. I think we sort of can accept that. So for us, there doesn't seem to be any contradiction with accepting that this clock depends on causes, conditions and parts, and yet, at the same time, believe that this clock exists completely independent of us. I think for most of us, we don't see a contradiction there. We're quite happy to accept the fact that this clock can exist independent of us, yet can have dependent on causes, conditions, parts. But this statement is saying that that's not possible. So what's going on here? What's going on is that our understanding of causes, conditions, and parts is fairly superficial. We don't really understand what they mean at a deeper level. To understand what these mean at a deeper level, we have to look at the third way in which this is a dependent arising. That this clock, or things in general, are dependent arising because they depend on imputation or labelling. Sometimes here is described as designation, conception, thought, many words used. So, what does it mean for this clock to exist depending on imputation, labelling, designation or conception? Again, we might think, oh, that means that there's a thing here and I'm giving it the name clock. And that's what it means that this clock is something existing on imputation or labelling or designation. That's not wrong, but again, it's very superficial understanding. Because, in fact, when we look out on the world, what's really going on is that we're just receiving a mass of sense data. And then, of course, we have to make some meaning out of all of this sense data, otherwise we'd never function. So what we do with all this sense data that's appearing to us is we draw lines around various collections of data and we make them into objects, that collection of data, to make sense, to make meaning out of what we see. But of course we don't exist in isolation in this world. We need to communicate with others. So on top of that, we have to give a name to those things so we can communicate. So labelling or designation or imputation is already happening when we're drawing a line around a collection of data. Even before we give it a name, we've effectively labelled or that is coming to existence. For example, and the way we divide up the world is not fixed or arbitrary. I mean, it's not fixed, it's arbitrary, depending on the meaning that we want to get out of the world. For instance, if you're looking in this direction here, then we could simply, around all of this data that you're receiving, just draw one line and say alter. Or you could draw three or four lines and say there's three or four statues there. Or you could draw eight lines and say there's eight offerings there. Or you could draw five lines and say there's five cupboards there. Depends completely on the meaning that you want to get out of that data. So is there one thing there? Is there three things? Is there four, five things? Is there eight things? How many things are there? Depends on the meaning we want to, the way we draw the lines. So then same thing with the clock, is that when we look in this direction, most often we would simply draw a line around this collection of data, conceptually isolate this collection of data here, make it into one object and then give it the name clock. So even when we draw the line, we've already labelled. So the clock comes into existence when we interpret that data and draw the line and give the name. So actually, there's no clock to be found here. The clock is something which is merely labelled on the basis of this data in this area here. So that's what it really means to impute or label something. Now let's go back and have a look at the first two based on this idea.
Where does the seed stop and the plant start?
Well,
when we label it.
Exactly. Is, but remember here, we believe in independent reality. Things existing independent of our conceptual framework. If that's the case, and a seed is a seed from its own side, and a plant is a plant from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework, it should be obvious at what point the seed stops and the plant starts. There should be a fixed point. It shouldn't be determined by our conceptual framework, because things exist independently of our framework. That's what we believe. But as you realise, is that when we look at this, is that, you know, we may say, okay, the point is here, that the seed stops and the plant starts. But we pick that point because, for us, this configuration of data looks more like a seed than our concept of seed, but this one here now more resembles our concept of plant. So it's when this configuration of data stops resembling our concept of seed and starts resembling our concept of plant, that's when the seed stops and the plant starts. So we determine when the plant comes into existence. You know? So hence things are merely labelled, merely imputed. On that very point, one interesting question that we can think about is, does the seed cease to exist before the plant comes into existence? Yes or no? So again, the question is, does the seed cease to exist before the plant comes into existence? Yes or no?
I'm going to go with yes.
So the seed ceases to exist before the plant comes into existence. So the seed...
I'm going to say the gap's very small.
Where do I know? We have to logically answer this correctly.
Yes.
You said yes.
Yes.
Yes means the seed has ceased to exist before the plant comes into existence. So the seed ceased to exist. Where's the plant coming from? There's no seed there anymore. Mm-hmm. Where's the plant coming from?
I could talk about karma. The line of karma giving rise. Let's not go there.
No, don't need to go there. So if you say yes, you have the problem, there's no seed, where's the plant come from? If you say no, what you're saying is that the seed then exists at the time of the plant. Illogical. Law of cause and effect, the cause cannot exist at time and effect. If it does, it's not cause and effect.
That's right.
So both options are illogical.
Mm-hmm.
And by using these line of reasoning, we can really come to appreciate that independent existence is illogical.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't think about these things.
Because it hurts too much.
But also, so Nagarjuna, great 2nd century master, in his great text, The Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way, he does exactly this for 27 chapters. He said, you believe in independent existence? What about this example? What happens here? And he gives us all these logical absurdities of a belief in independent existence. It would imply this. And so those sorts of reasonings can also help us to really appreciate that independent existence is just illogical. Whereas for us here, with dependent arising merely labeled, merely imputed, we don't have that problem, because the point is when we simply change our designation. So we don't have that logical absurdity. And so reasonings like this can really help us to think about the idea of independent existence and how they really doesn't make any sense at all. And so Nagarjuna does like 27 chapters of this. And so he keeps pulling the rug from under our feet, saying, you believe in independent existence? What about this situation? What's the story? And we go, okay, yeah, it doesn't really make sense, does it? So that's very powerful reasoning. Okay, let's now look at the parts one in more detail. So we say this pen exists depending on its parts. But we believe there's a pen existing there, independent of our conception. We say this is a pen. But where is the pen here that we believe in? So, is this a pen? Is that a pen? No. Is this a pen? This tube? No. Is this blue plastic thing on the end a pen? No. Is the ink in the middle here a pen? Just the ink. No. Is this metal tube on its own a pen? Is the little round ball thing at the end a pen? Where's the pen? Where's the pen? Then people say, oh, yeah, yeah, well, that's easy. The pen's the collection. That's usually what people say.
Put it together.
Oh.
In a certain way.
Ah, so there you go. There's the collection. Is that a pen?
That's merely parts.
Right, so the question is, when does a pen come into existence? Tell me, okay? Pen yet? Will you have a pen yet? You got a pen yet? No? Not quite. Okay, there. We got a pen? We got a pen? Not really. Tell me exactly when the pen comes into existence. Don't miss it. Don't miss it. You got to tell me. No, no, no. No one said yet. Oh. That's not a pen, still. Oh, I think it's a pen. Okay, so the question is, when does pen come into existence? The pen comes into existence when this collection of data resembles or matches our concept of pen. Our concept of pen usually has two things. Most of our concepts have at least two things: appearance and functionality. So when this appearance matches our concept of pen plus functionality matches, then the pen comes into existence, not before. So for us, we have a concept of pen usually which is a sort of long thing and a tippy thing on the end, and that a pen's function is that you can write with it. If a caveman walked in this door, would there be a pen here?
No.
No. Probably some sort of weapon, you know, stabbing something. If a dog walked in the room, is there a pen here?
Toy.
Some sort of toy or chewing thing. So is this a pen, a chewing thing, or is it a weapon?
Labeled.
Yes. So again, we can appreciate then that the pen is something labelled depending on these parts. Now here's a point that can help us to know whether our understanding of emptiness is going somewhere. Normally we say this is a pen, that the pen is the collection of the parts. Yeah, that's what we normally think. The pen is this collection of parts here. That's a pen. Normally that's what we say. The second statement this view is saying is that the pen is merely labelled depending on this collection of parts. So the two statements are the pen is the collection of the parts versus the pen is labelled depending on the collection of the parts. If we can appreciate that those two things are not saying the same thing, we're beginning to understand something about emptiness. And here is exactly another example of cognitive fusion, our old friend the cognitive fusion. The basis, the label, are two things. There's a basis here of data. We have a label pen that we're applying to the basis. But we fuse the pen and the basis and we say this is a pen. So that's again, we are fusing the label with the basis. Whereas this view is saying that the pen is something we merely labelled depending on the basis. So the pen is not the basis, but that's what we believe.
But you have to have the basis before you can label it.
But again, also same with anger. We have to have an agent who has the anger.
Yeah.
So you have to have, an object, you have to have to have a behaviour, you have to have an agent. So to have a pen, you have to have a basis. So they're dependent, but they're not the same thing. But that's what we believe. Same as we identify with anger. I am angry. That is a nasty person. We're identifying two things, making them one. Same here. We've got the basis and we've got the label. In fact, we can call this what's called basis of designation, and the pen is the designated object. So the basis of designation depends on the designation, and the designation depends on the basis. Yeah? No?
Yes.
But they're not the same thing.
No.
And they're not two independent things. They are dependent.
Yeah.
Yeah. But again, the old cognitive fusion makes them one. And then, problem. This is a pen. I mean, correctly, we should be saying a pen is something we're labelling on this basis, if we want to be technically correct. So again, our language is reinforcing this false view. Like our language, I am angry, that's a bad person, is reinforcing problems for us. Same here, our language is reinforcing these ideas.
Yeah.
Now, again, what we do, of course, is when we look out on the world, we have to draw lines and give names. Otherwise, we couldn't function. And I think actually a newborn baby can't even draw lines. They don't know how to draw lines. In fact, they have to learn that. And actually we ourselves are constantly improving our line drawing ability to make better and better meaning out of the things we see. But the problem, of course, is that we don't realise that we're doing this line drawing all the time. We believe that the world is already divided up into these separate things as soon as we see them. You know, we look and it looks to us as already there's a thing, single thing there called a chair. We don't realise that actually there's just a mass of data coming in here, and I am drawing a line there, turning that collection of data into an object and labelling chair. We don't realise we're doing that. So what we're doing is we're turning this line drawing into boundaries, hard boundaries. So we believe the world is full of boundaries, full of separate discrete things. Now of course when we look out on the world, one of the very first lines we draw is we draw a line around here, and we conceptually isolate the observer, or the me, the experiencer. Because we have single experience. There's a single experience. Within experience there's two aspects. There's the experiencer and the experienced, or subject and object. Observer, observed. However you want to, me and the world, however you want to give the labels within that experience. And of course we have to draw that line and give the label me. Otherwise, like I said, a baby can't even do that. A baby can't even distinguish itself from the world, and so it can't really do anything. So there's no problem with drawing a line labelling me. But the problem is, again, we don't realise we're doing that. We believe that there's already an independent, separate me here. And to highlight that example, I always use an example like the following. Is this big? Is this big?
Exactly.
Yeah, so maybe we'll just take the little black thing on the tip. So big can only exist relative to small. You can't have big on its own. It just doesn't make sense. Like you can't have up without down, in without out. And you can't have me without not me, or the world. You can't have subject without object. You can't have observer without observed. It just does not make sense. But what we do, of course, is that not only we draw a line and give a label me, but we split ourselves off from the world. We contract around the me part of the experience. We believe that there's a boundary here between me and the world. A boundary. There's an independent me here and an independent world there. But that belief is exactly the same as saying this is big. Just does not make sense. How can you have big on its own? How can you have me on its own? Because me can only exist relationship to not me, or subject to object, or observer to observed. It just does not make sense. But that's what we believe in. We grasp, we contract around the me part of the experience, we turn that line into a hard boundary, and this is called self-grasping. Grasping onto this independent me, independent world. And this is where the problems begin. Now, to understand that a little bit better, that that's really what's going on, is very often in our experiences, we are consciously aware of the agent, the me. I am going here, I am doing that, I am seeing this, I am doing, being there, you know, I. So either consciously or a little bit subconsciously, we're continuously contracting around the me part of the experience with this self-grasping, splitting ourselves off. And of course, when we do that, then we're completely out of sync with reality. When we're seeing ourselves as independent of the world, and on that basis we act, we're completely out of sync with reality. And so then we struggle and we're fighting against reality. We fight against reality, we struggle, we suffer, and the people around us suffer. But sometimes in our experiences, we're not so consciously grasping onto the me, contracting around the me. And often this happens in situations where we are quite focused. You know, if we're focused on some activity, we're often then focused more on the activity rather than me doing the activity, me going, me saying, more on the activity. So then the contraction around the me is a little bit relaxed, not so strong. And we all have this experience, you know, for instance, we're absorbed in a good book, absorbed in a movie, absorbed maybe in solving a problem at work. When we're in those situations and there's less grasping onto the me, generally our experience is much better. Generally things flow a lot better, time seems to go quite quickly, things seem to be more harmonious. And that's because we're not so actively contracting around the me, splitting ourselves off, we're not so out of sync as we normally are. That's why things go better. And this is very much highlighted in people who have a high level of concentration. Like people who've trained for many years, maybe like professional athletes, professional musicians, who have trained year after year after year, focus on their activity. And so often these people report that when they're in that state of playing the music or engaging in the sporting activity, they say they're in the zone or in the flow state. And so there, due to the high level of concentration, the grasping onto the me is very, very much reduced. And so then they often report that there's no real longer any sense of an agent. There's just the music. There's just the sporting activity. That's what they report. And they also report optimum performance, peak performance. Why? Because the grasping onto the me is very low, very much reduced. Not struggling against reality. More harmonious, in sync with reality. That's why things flow better. That's why they have peak performance. Of course, here we're talking about reducing the contraction through the power of concentration. So we're not eliminating the contraction, it's just subdued a little bit through the force of concentration. If we want to eliminate the contraction, we need to eliminate the ignorance. We need to develop this wisdom of emptiness, shunyata. So if we develop this wisdom of emptiness, shunyata, we can completely eliminate the contraction, be completely in sync with reality. And so that's what we need to do. And of course, by by the concentration, we are simply reducing the amount of contraction. With wisdom, we are coming to realize the fact that there's no boundary between us and anything else. There's not a single boundary in this universe. So if we can really realize that there's no boundary between us and others, we can develop boundless love and compassion for everyone. As long as we believe there's somehow a boundary here, there's a me here and then there's them there, it becomes quite difficult to fully develop love and compassion for others, because we'll still see that feeling of separateness. So if we really want to fully develop love and compassion for others, we need to overcome this sense of separateness, this sense that there's somehow a boundary between us and others. And so we can do that with this wisdom of emptiness. Now, to help us better appreciate again this idea of emptiness, very often in Buddhist teachings, when some topic is being introduced, particularly if it's not so easy to understand, then often a simple analogy is used to help better understand the more profound topic. And so here in the idea of emptiness, there are many analogies that are presented. One that really I like a lot, that's used quite often, is the analogy of a dream. Now, when we're dreaming, while we're in the dream, within the dream, there really appears to be a dream me and a dream world. That there's a dream me and an independent, objective dream world out there while we're in the middle of the dream. And then, of course, if in the dream we see a monster in our dream, then, of course, we develop a lot of fear in our dream and try to escape from the monster. But if in the dream suddenly we realize we're dreaming within the dream without waking up, what's called lucid dreaming, then when we realize that this is just a dream, then of course the dream doesn't stop, but our perspective of the dream is completely different. We can come to directly experience the fact that even though this dream world appears to be out there, we realize in the dream that this is just a product of our mind. Therefore, if a monster comes then, and we're in the middle of a lucid dream, actually it would become very difficult to be afraid of the monster, because we'll understand that this monster is a product of our mind. So if the monster appears, we may say, "Oh, hi, Mr. Monster, how are you? You know, you look like you're a bit upset, can I help you?" So our dream would actually become much more enjoyable, and it would be difficult to develop any disturbing emotions in our dream. Likewise, what this view is saying, in our waking world, we are now asleep with ignorance. We believe that just like in a dream, that there's a waking me here and a world out there completely independent of us. And so what this view is saying is, if we realize emptiness, if we wake up from the sleep of ignorance, and we realize that this waking world is also a product of our mind, that it's not something independent of our conceptual framework, then, again, no matter what occurred in our world, it would become very difficult to develop any disturbing emotions with respect to anything we perceive, and we would enjoy life a lot more. So that, I think, is a very good analogy to help us better appreciate what we mean by this view of emptiness. Now, another way to understand if we are understanding something about this view of emptiness is that now, for us, there's two possibilities. Either there is this solid, real, functioning world, or there's no world. There doesn't seem to be a third possibility. Either there is a solid, objective world there, or there's no world at all. There doesn't really seem to be a third possibility. That's it. Now, when we investigate this view of emptiness, and we investigate this supposed real, objective, solid world, emptiness undermines the fact that there's this solid, independent world out there. So for us, emptiness seems to be saying that there's not really a functioning world out there, that it's all some hallucination. So nothing really exists. So for us now, emptiness seems to contradict the fact that there's a real functioning world, and a real functioning world out there seems to contradict that things are empty of independent existence. So these two ideas appear to be contradictory: a functioning world and emptiness. But as we work on our emptiness understanding more and more, then instead of thinking them to be contradictory, we'll start to say things like, okay, despite the fact that things are empty, they do work. And despite the fact that things work, they are empty of independent existence. So that's a measure of progress. But the real measure that we really understand, we're starting to understand emptiness quite well, is if we can come to the conclusion that because things are empty of independent existence, they can function. And because things function, they must be empty of independent existence. If we can really appreciate that, we are starting to appreciate emptiness quite well. So here what we can say is that emptiness and dependent arising or functioning world are like two sides of one coin. Emptiness of independent existence, dependent arising, functioning world are two sides of one coin. In fact, if this clock was a clock from its own side, if its nature was to be a clock, it couldn't do anything. You couldn't destroy it, it couldn't change, you couldn't create it, because its nature is to be a clock from its own side. That's its nature. It's inherently a clock, independent of conceptual framework. Therefore, in fact, it couldn't change, it couldn't function, couldn't do anything. As well, that would imply that, yes. But because things are empty of independent existence, therefore they can change, they can function, they can get created, they can be destroyed, they can change. So, in fact, this idea of change and impermanence is also something helpful in this view of emptiness. If we really can experientially appreciate impermanence, the fact that things are constantly changing, that can be very helpful in understanding emptiness. It's not the same thing, but it's a good step. It helps us to move in that direction. So impermanence also is something helpful in coming to appreciate emptiness. Any questions? Just about time for it. In fact, it's time for a break. And in fact, that's exactly where I wanted to round it off, what I wanted to say. Any last question then before we take a break? Okay, let's take a break. Tea break.